WCAE,
which was both a blessing and a curse, I guess.
This presentation
and
recorded
I knew
live
in the, very
CCI
first year
Conference
or two
Services.
That I hadn't ever gotten around to teaching geography. You know, it was the first year. You know, you didn't know what you were doing, and I was inventing a lot of things as I went along. But within a year, I was hooked up in a homeschool organization. I ended up becoming director of it. And as we had our homeschool meetings, our monthly, what we called faculty meetings, one of the questions that came up was, well, what do you use to teach geography? And I kind of hemmed and hawed and basically had to say, I've got maps. But I realized then that I wasn't doing a very thorough job of teaching geography. And I thought back to when I was in seventh grade and I took an actual geography class in school. Maybe you all had this experience. A whole year of geography, we never opened an atlas. We didn't have any maps on the wall, didn't have a globe. The whole thing was taught from a textbook. And it was incredibly dull. They would have had to work to make it more boring than what it was. And at that point on, I thought I hated geography, although I like a lot of geographic things. If you said to me taking a geography course, I would have said, boring. So someone asked if we would do a meeting on geography, teaching geography, and I agreed to it. And as I began to research, I realized that there was a lot more to geography than what I understood, and that there's a lot more out there available to teach with than what I had previously known. What I want to do today, I want to do a couple of things. I want to teach you what geography really is, what it encompasses. I want to show you how to be a knowledgeable consumer about geographic materials and to choose age-appropriate type resources. And then I want to show you as many kid-produced projects as I have time for, and I'll go through them rather rapidly. One caveat, there's been a few times people have come up to me afterwards and said, oh my gosh, you've done so much, I could never do all that, it's overwhelming. Please remember, what I'm showing you today was not done in a year. What I'm showing you today, I did not even do all these things. My kids are older now. My oldest has graduated. My youngest is going into high school. And I'm still looking for good geography ideas for the elementary ages. So I'm at the point where I often buy geography projects from young children in our co-op or in our private group, our private school. So what you're seeing passed around, don't get overwhelmed and think, well, I could never do all this. Well, you don't have to do all this. You know, the idea is to, one, be aware of what geography is, and two, pick and choose things that you can incorporate comfortably into your lifestyle and into your family. Okay, first off, I've never done this with a handheld mic, and I've got all this stuff to show, so this is going to get, if you see me with it under there, you'll know why. I'm going to ask you, what comes to your mind, what's the first thing you think of when I say geography? Just call it out. Maps. Okay, we'll keep going. Atlases, places, capitals. Culture, countries, resources, okay, mountains, snakes, she's right, what else? Water, oh, states, well, actually, snakes too, we'll get into that in a minute. States, very good. When I give this workshop all over the East Coast, and the first answer I invariably get is maps, followed closely by either atlases, globes, or Carmen Sandiego. I want to read you a definition of geography from the National Geographic Society, and it's the best definition I've ever read of geography. Let me read this, and you can either just jot down a couple of notes or just listen and think about the question would be, what doesn't geography encompass? Here's the definition. Geography is a knowledge of place names, location of cultural and physical features, distribution and patterns of languages, religions, economic activities, population, and political systems. Physical regions and physical phenomena such as tectonic activity, landform, climate, bodies of water, soils, flora, and fauna. There's your plants and animals. The changes in places and area through time, including how people have modified the environment. Cartographers' tools such as maps, graphs, and statistics are also a part of geography. So what we first think of, typically maps, that's the tool that a cartographer or someone who studies geography will use, but that is not geography. And once you hear those questions, you go, wow, there's a lot more out there than what maybe I thought. Speaking of the National Geographic Society, raise your hand if your students have participated in the National Geography B. A couple people in here have done that. I highly encourage you, if you have not already pursued that, it's very simple. During the summer, you call National Geographic Society, ask for their information packet. What you'll need to do is register yourself as a, they'll call you a school, and that's okay. They know that there's homeschool, trust me, they know there's homeschoolers doing it. South Carolina, you probably know, a young man from South Carolina won last year the Geography Bee. You need 6 students in grades 4 through 8. Now that could be 6 fourth graders, it could be 2 fourth graders, 2 sixth graders, 2 eighth graders, it doesn't matter, as long as you have 6 students in grades 4, 5, 6, 7, or 8. Last year they charged $30. I don't know if that's going to go up or not, but it's approximately $30. They'll send you, if you register with a school, you'll be the principal or the director, whatever you want to call yourself. They'll send you a packet out in September, early October, with all the information to hold your bee. And we have found it good for two reasons. The first reason, it's motivating. It gives your students a real reason to study for something. And secondly, as we're studying, we're learning so much geography that whether we do the bee or not, we've come out ahead. We've done the bee now for about 5 or 6 years, and we have found the questions to be really interesting. And I'm going to give you a couple off of one of the bees recently, and you guys can shout out the answers. Now, the reason I'm doing this is I don't want you to be intimidated. You might say, well, we've never done geography. My children really don't know very much. That's fine. Start where you are. The bee is not held until end of December, early January. Start where you are, and this again, this will give them a reason to want to study. The questions start out easier. It's set up in rounds, and the first 2 or 3 rounds are either-or questions. Teach them how to guess, because they have a 50-50 chance of getting the questions right. Then as the rounds progress, the questions do get more difficult, but no one is eliminated until the end of the third round. So it's not like, oh, you got that one wrong, you have to go sit down. That would be devastating to one of my children. It's the thing where at the end of 3 rounds, then a group of students would be eliminated. All right, here's some questions. I'll start it with easier ones, and then I'll work my way forward. Okay, most of the wheat in the United States is grown in which region, the Great Plains or the Colorado Plateau? Great Plains, okay. Name the equatorial river that carries more water than the combined flow of the Mississippi, Nile, and Congo rivers. Amazon. Okay, we went from a round 1 question to a round 3 question. I didn't mean to do that, but we did. Okay, let me skip down here. To hire a Sherpa guide, this is from round 4 or 5 now, to hire a Sherpa guide to help you climb Mount Everest, you would most likely have to travel to which Asian country? Nepal. Okay. What is the predominant religion of people living in the independent countries of Central Asia? Islam. Okay. Now we're getting into the harder later round questions. Name the easternmost country in the region known as the Horn of Africa. Somalia. And let's see. Throw a little easier one in here for you guys. Okay, how about this one? Poland, France, and Denmark all border what country? Shout it out if you know. Germany. The little girl in the blue sweater. Throw her a globe. Can we pass that globe back there? If she got that answer right, I'm impressed. Quickly, too. Anyway, my point is there's lots of geography types questions. It's not just naming places. It's people. It's animals. It's religions. It's cultures. It's all kinds of things. Now, when you began teaching geography, where do you start? Well, you're going to need some resources. Having appropriate geographic resources is just as important as having appropriate resources for your language arts or for your math. Every home here probably has a Bible. Every home here probably has grade appropriate dictionaries. Do you put your second grader in your college level Random House?
No.
You know, do you have grade appropriate or age appropriate materials for studying all your other subjects? Okay, you want to do the same thing for geography. Oftentimes people will come to my booth and they'll be buying something and I'll just say, well, do you have an atlas? Because that to me is one of the most important things that you need to have in the home. And they'll say, oh yeah, we have an atlas. My husband has this great atlas from when he was in college. Did he graduate recently? Oh no, that was about 20 years ago. Great. It might be a wonderful atlas, but it's woefully out of date and it's a college level atlas. And if you're teaching your 8-year-old, that atlas is going to be way overwhelming. They're not going to be able to deal with it. So I want to first show you some differences and what to look for in atlases. I'm going to start out young and work our way up to the college level. For young children, and this is going to get tricky with this microphone, they brought a stand. Oh, bless them. Hold on. Oh, yay. Thank you. Okay. If you're starting with young children, pre-K through about second grade, there's a couple of different atlases on the market, but what you want to look for is large and colorful to begin with. If it's not attractive, they're not going to be particularly interested in looking at it. Secondly, you want to look at the information that's included. Is there good, solid information? Do they have the country names? Do they have keys or legends? Because kindergarten is not too young to introduce the concept of a key or a legend. This one does it using animals oftentimes or products, things that are grown in the country, and it has keys or legends for each country. You also want to make sure that when you're picking out maps or atlases, not necessarily an atlas, but in a wall map, that your projection is such that Africa is centered basically in your wall map. A lot of maps made in America have the United States in the center. And what happens when you do that, besides it's very distorted because they have to drop it down and center it, and it makes it look bigger than what it really is. But the difficult thing about USA being in the center is Asia is then split. And you have Asia on the left-hand side and the right-hand side, and that's a difficult concept for children when you're talking about the continents. You know, why is half the continent on this side? So if Africa is in the center, then Asia is pretty much in one place. All right, so you start with large print, something colorful. Then you're going to work your way up a little bit. And again, when you get into elementary, you still want something that's clear and easy to read. There needs to be some detail, but you don't want overwhelming detail. Children that age do not typically need to know, you know, every city in Asia. You know, they're looking for the major cities. They're looking for the capitals and the waterways, things like that. So you want a political map, you want a physical map included, and you want in some information and some photographs about the culture, about the people. This one's called the Classroom Atlas. It's made by Rand McNally. It was updated this year, and that's what I recommend for the elementary ages. When you move up into junior high, somewhere around 7th to 8th grade, depending on the student, you're going to go to an upper-level atlas. And what makes it upper-level? Look at the difference in the print, if you can see in the back, the difference in the print between the last atlas and this atlas. This is called the Answer Atlas. It's a wonderful atlas. I tried to use it, however, with my son when he had just gone into 6th grade, and I thought he was ready to move up from the classroom into this. And he was very frustrated trying to find places in this atlas because the print was too small. So you need to know your student and to know whether it's appropriate or not. This one is interesting too because it has lots of information about each of the continents. It has the hottest, the coldest, the longest, the shortest, about places around the world. And it also has a section on the flags of the countries around the world, which is a neat study that you can do as the flags, and I'll talk about that later. One way to judge the complexity of an atlas is look into the gazetteer or the index in the back of the book. As an example, this is a fairly small gazetteer. It's not thick. You can see there's just maybe 10 or 15 pages in the back. That means as far as detail, it's not one of the most detailed atlases. When you move up into something like this, which is called the Premier, and you go to look at the gazetteer in the back of it, it's a good quarter of the book is the index or the gazetteer. So you can see there's much more detail in a map this size. The difference in this map, too, is it does not have the thematic maps. I don't know if I showed you those. A thematic map is something like population, climate, things like that, where you take one country or continent and you focus in on different things about that continent. This one does not have thematic maps, but it does have each of the states done individually. So if you were doing state studies, that might be useful. Then you get into college level. If you really need a very, very thorough atlas, the goods is considered the cream of the crop of atlases. And I would say probably over a quarter of the book is the gazetteer. So you know it's very detailed. The goods also does have a number of thematic type maps in addition. Everything from, let's see, this one is on agriculture. It has coal mining operations, refugee populations. There's all kinds of things that you might do at a really upper level high school or college level. There are also, I just want to go over briefly, different types of atlases besides world and USA atlases. There are historical atlases. A lot of times you'll be doing have you ever done ancient Egypt and you got to something about identifying Memphis and you look in your map and Memphis doesn't exist in ancient Egypt anymore? Now it's in Tennessee. It moved. My kids thought that was really interesting. So you need what's called an historical atlas. Now at your library, for free, they do have books in the reference section that have historical maps. And one is called Historical Maps by Facts on File, F-A-C-T-S, Facts on File. They're great maps. They usually will allow you to photocopy them in the right at the library. They'll let you check it out for your own use. I've used those a couple of times. They're black and white, and you know, you can photocopy them and write on them. However, I find this to be very handy. This is called the Historical Atlas of the World. And if I'm doing ancient Rome, this shows me what the boundaries were. If I'm doing the Crusades, this shows me the movement. If I'm doing explorers, it shows me where the explorers came from and where they were going. So it goes chronologically, starting with ancient civilizations. Here's Revolutionary War maps. It does have some United States history, although personally I prefer for United States history an atlas of American history, because it's very detailed and it starts back at the beginning of the country and it works its way forward. With trade routes and explorers and who owned what when and major civil war battles, all those sorts of things. So don't forget that not only do you want to have a good current atlas, but it's very helpful in your history studies to have historical atlases. And of course, for Bible studies or for ancient civilizations, a good Bible atlas. And you may have one in the back of your Bible. Just make sure it's big enough, colorful enough, you know, that the younger students are able to use it. Okay. I want to go on from there to the large maps. I mentioned that you want to have Africa in the center. There's two different kinds of large maps. The first one is a reference map. This is what you may have up in your home right now. It's color, has lots of names on it. Reference maps are great. I have them all over the place. And when we're sitting around the dinner table at night, my husband in particular will like to talk. He likes to talk about current events, especially something just happened that, you know, makes you want to call your congressman. And as you're talking about things that are happening, we would have the kids go up to the map on the wall and point out where we were talking about. And that was good. That kind of helped them to find their way around the world. Well, I got misled into thinking that they really knew where all these places were because they were very quick at pointing them out. Well, my kids are very quick readers, is really what was going on. And when I added an outline map that did not have any places labeled on it, I found out what they did and what they didn't know. So there's two kinds of maps. A reference map is already labeled, and an outline map is simply typically a black and white map that has country borders. It might have rivers or lakes. Some of them may even have mountains, but there's no text. There's no labeling on it. When you look at a black and white, the first time I looked at one of these, I thought, that is the most boring map I've ever seen. It's black and white. You know, it wasn't appealing to me. I did not realize all the things that you could do with it. But an outline map can be used for the children to write in what they're learning or to color in what they're learning. Let's say, for example, that you're doing American history and you're doing the westward expansion. We did this a couple of years ago, and this is the map that we ended up with. As we went through the country unit by unit, we added it to the map, color-coded it, keyed it in, and it helped us to visualize how our country came together. Because if you stop and just ask any student, well, you know, why was California one of the later states admitted to the Union? Or why was, you know, when did Louisiana come in? Historically, it's confusing. But if you look at it geographically, it helps to solidify, well, yeah, there's a reason why the country came together the way it did. Look at it on a map and follow it on a map. And now when I think back to that unit, myself, I think of this map. This map comes to my mind. It's the same thing with the kids. It just helps them to remember it, not only seeing it visually, but if they've had a hand drawing it, what we do with our hands, we tend to remember longer. That's the point behind hands-on things. So here's another example. If you really want to get visual, you can cut out pictures. You can color it in, draw in pictures of the people as you're talking about the explorers. This family cut out pictures of some of the different explorers and taped them on there. And that just helped their children to remember. The other cool thing that you can do, if you're keeping a timeline with your history studies, and we have a poster-style timeline, I didn't bring it, but you can take the same figures or the same picture on your map, add it to your timeline, vice versa. So you're seeing that same picture in two places. You're connecting not just where it happened, but when it happened. And it's a double whammy. The kids are going to remember it because their hands are involved in it. They're remembering what they're doing. And, of course, maps can also be used for more than just geography or history. Science is very geographic. A lot of your science topics, earth science, oceanography, astronomy, a lot of those are also geography topics. You could do the Ring of Fire. You could do animals and habitats, those kinds of things. This is a weather map that was done. You can do all kinds of things on maps with your science. So when you're doing a science course, if it's something related to geography, think about including a map for that also. A quick tip on using outline maps. The first time I used this map, I got it, and the label is up here. So, of course, I held the map up like this. And I stared at it for a while, and I went, where is this? I don't get it. And it took me a minute to realize that the label was there, but the label actually goes this way, and the map goes like this. And the easiest way to teach your children how to identify places on an outline map to get started is look for bodies of water. If you can identify a lake or an ocean or some major body of water, a peninsula would be next, some sort of physical feature. Once they identified one place in their atlas and they've matched it to the map, then they can go out in increasingly bigger circles and they can keep labeling outwards. But if you just gave me this map and say, you know, I want you to label, you know, you know, I'd be doing this for a while first. You know, it's a lot easier if I start with the Mediterranean Sea and work my way across. So that's just a tip for using outline maps. Okay, I want to spend a few minutes on projects. I said before, what we perform, we tend to remember. There's all kinds of different geography projects you can do. The one that I like to start with when I'm doing any new history study is a Salto map. Now, this poor Salto map is getting dragged all around the country. Make a new one every year, but Salto is not meant to last forever, and it doesn't. It's the nice thing about it, you don't have to keep it forever. Salto maps are simply salt, flour, and water. They don't have to be messy. I'm not an arts and crafts person. I don't really get into the messy projects, but this is something very simple and easy to do. What you're going to do is pick whatever you're doing for history. Whether this happened when we were doing, a couple years ago, we were doing ancient Egypt. I got my son, we got the atlas out, looked at the physical map or a relief map of ancient Egypt so he could see where the rivers, the mountains, whatever were. Then, for him, he was younger at the time, we photocopied that map and taped it underneath so he had something to work from. Okay? But then he had to look in the atlas and figure out, not just from what was taped underneath, but he had to really keep looking at the atlas as you cover this up. And what he found out was, there's actually mountains over in Egypt, you know? It's not something you think about when you think of Egypt. But when he got, by the time he finished this map, when we were getting into our history study, he had a very good understanding of the places that we were talking about and the obstacles that people overcome and what was going on, because he understood the lay of the land. And that's very important. People tend to forget that, but the lay of the land is often the reason why a lot of these historical events happen. So by doing a physical, a Salto map of some description, a Play-Doh map, you know, you can make it out of, I have a friend that makes it out of cookies and they eat it when they're through. I mean, you know, and anytime you can tie food into a class, I think that's great. The color, I have friends who paint their maps. I never get paints out. I don't think I even own any paints. What we did was we used food coloring, and we just divided up into batches. We knew we had desert. We knew we had some Fertile Crescent, not very much, and we knew we had water. So we just made a green, a blue, a green, and a yellow. And so we just worked with food coloring. And it was a lot brighter when we first did it. They look great for about a month or so, and then they lose their color. What I like to do with all these hands-on projects, by the way, having moved last year and moving again this year, don't save them all. The ones that they spend a lot of time on, you save the longest. You know, the ones that they threw together in the afternoon to you know, for a quickie that they had to do for a co-op or to please you, and they didn't really care about, that's been something that really warrants being saved. But the ones that they spend a lot of time on, obviously you're going to save a little longer. But what I do is I take photographs of them soon after they're made. Don't wait a couple of weeks. Things happen to those projects. Take a photograph of them as they finish it or when they're finished. Save the photographs. Hold on to the project for a reasonable amount of time. And then, you know, a lot of our projects, we use things over and over again. My son made a map for The Hobbit this year in our literature class. We were doing The Hobbit as one of our stories, and he made a Salto map with The Hobbit, and he took a lot of his little figures. You know how boys have all these boxes of, I don't know where they come from, but figures multiply in the closet, and he pulled all these figures out and had them represent different characters in The Hobbit. So when we were through, we took a picture, we saved the map for a little while, and then he had great fun chopping all his figures out of the Salto to keep the figures and throw the map away. So, I talked before about food. I do want to mention this. A couple of years ago, we had a friend whose son at the time was 12. And his mom, my girlfriend, is a second generation Polish, and her husband is first generation Mexican. And their families, when they got together, like at birthdays or weddings or whatever, tended to stay apart. What she would say is they just don't have a lot in common besides us, you know, culturally wise. So her son, as one of his projects for history, was doing a little genealogical research. And one of the things that he decided to do was to collect recipes from all his various relatives. So they wrote letters and sent them to relatives actually all over the world. They sent letters to relatives they had never met, that, you know, somebody's Aunt Flo remembered this first cousin who, you know, one of those things. And they got back a surprising amount of responses. And they asked people to send us back a recipe that has something to do with your heritage, or a favorite family recipe, an anecdote, if, you know, that maybe apply, and a photograph of yourself if you can spare one. And he got letters back from all kinds of people. And it was so neat that he decided, and his mom helped him with this, to go ahead and compile a cookbook of their family recipes. And they scanned in the photo, or they photographed, they didn't have a scanner, it was before scanners. They photographed, you know, on a copy machine, the person's photograph when they had one to go along. And the anecdote, they typed them up and put that in there. And the neat thing was that Christmas, he had them bound, and they sent them to everyone who participated. They sent back a cookbook. And they said at the next family get-together, they could see people talking to each other that hadn't talked to each other, that there was a relationship born really from this book. I get goosebumps because it was just really neat. But, I mean, this is one of the things I want to pass around. You can take a look at that. But, you know, your family's history is a wonderful way to study not just history but geography. Whether you've been in America for, you know, six generations or you're just off the boat, there's so much that your children are excited about learning because it's part of them. And you're always more excited about learning something that affects you directly. So you could do it with recipes. You could do it with clothing. You could do it with stories of games and things, or anything about the culture and the people where your family came from. Speaking of cooking, there's this really cool book called Kids Around the World Cook. And it has recipes from about 22 different countries or regions around the world. And what I like is it's very simply laid out, and it has something about the history of that place. And it has something of the vocabulary on each of the recipes. I think it's a really neat little cookbook if you're doing something like that. It's called Kids Around the World Cook. I talked about games a minute ago. I have a friend who wanted to teach her young children about cultures around the world, and they did cooking was one of the things they did, but they also did games. And there's two ways to look at games around the world. One, you can look at games that come from specific places around the world. You know, you can look at Mancala, you can look at chess, you can look at different games that are specific to certain regions or certain areas. You can also look at games here and what their counterparts are around the world. And she found this book called Hopscotch Around the World, 19 Ways to Play the Game. And she and her kids went through and made and played a lot of these games. And they learned about a little bit about that country as they went through it. And the kids enjoyed it because there's a relationship there. Oh, these kids play hopscotch. Now that's an immediate bond, something that they can understand. And what was cool, when they got to France, I have to show you this, when they got to France, hopscotch in France is shaped like a snail, and the game is called escargot. And the kids got to learn that they eat snails in France. You know, there was something about that that was interesting to them. We won't go there. But anyway, every country has got a little story about the game or about the people or something to help you relate to it. And my friend Darlene, who did this, she's the queen of the frugal homeschoolers. She went to the dollar store where she does a lot of her purchasing, and she found the dollar picnic tablecloth with the kind of the felt back and the vinyl top, and she bought a whole stack of them. And the kids and Darlene stenciled the hopscotch games right on the tablecloth, and they could store them right in the original plastic container. They photocopied the directions out of the book, taped it to the container, kept them, and they could play these inside. They played them at birthday games, you know, birthday parties, things like that, but it helped the kids to remember something about what they had learned. So that's an idea, something that you can do. I'm not going to pass this around. It's too big, but we'll just float that up there. Games, okay. Grab some other stuff over here. other things you can do for around the world kind of things. This is for any age. I did this with my sons when they were, I guess, 10 and 15. We had read about this in a National Geographic magazine, about sending the teddy bear around the world. Have you all ever read that? Well, we did it. This is William. William comes with a little backpack, which is why we bought William. By the way, actually, this is William's twin. William never came home. But we bought two, because we suspected William may never came home. So we got two. We kept the twin at home. What we did was we put a little letter in the back pocket, asking in a little notebook-type journal and a pen, asking people to write a little something about where they were from, maybe where they were going, and if they had a spare coin they could put in, a stamp, maybe even a postcard. And we put Tyler, my younger son's address, and his email address, and said, you know, and Tyler wrote the letter. And so we said, please tell us something about you, you know, maybe write us or put it in the backpack of William. And it was incredible. Within a few weeks, we sent him off to India with a friend who was on her way to India. And within a couple of weeks, we had a notebook filled with emails and postcards from all over the world. And the emails were so interesting because so many of the people who wrote them, English was obviously not their first language. It was the first experience for my son of really trying to decipher what someone meant, you know, who was not writing it from a first language. And it gave him appreciation of how difficult that must be to do. We got stamps. I think I mentioned the postcards, all kinds of things. And the really cool thing that happened was that somewhere along the way, William got picked up by somebody in Bangkok, and who's a reporter. And this reporter wrote an article and put it in the English-speaking newspaper in Bangkok. And three or four people then cut out the newspaper article because they included Tyler's address in the newspaper article and sent it back to us. And what was neat, since we didn't get William back, it was neat, in the article they mentioned many of the things that were in the backpack. So we knew that people were doing it. And we just figured some child somewhere fell in love with William and adopted him. And that's the way it goes. Now, little tip, don't send your beloved teddy bear around the world. We went to Walmart the night before, because my son will bond instantly with any stuffed animal. We went the night before and bought William. Now, today, there's a problem. If you've flown in the last 3 years, you know that they're going to ask you, has anyone you don't know given you anything that, you know, like William's going to carry drugs around? So you can't give it to a perfect stranger on the plane and say, please take William on the next leg. You used to be able to do that. But there are ways around that. For example, this bear, and I want to pass this around, he flew by military transport all around the world. A classroom sponsored him, and he went from Air Force Base to Air Force Base and came back decorated with medals and stuff. It was really cool. You could do it trains across the United States if you're doing a USA study. You could do cruise ship. You got a parent taking a cruise, those senior citizens would love something like this. I mean, tell something about where you came from and something about your life as a child or whatever you wanted to put in there. You can learn so much geography that way. So about going around the world, though, if you're going to send a William across the world, you need to have him go from person. I give him to someone that I know who's going somewhere. When they get there, they give him to someone that they know there or they've met there and ask him. So you're just doing it. It's a little bit slower. You're not handing them off on the plane, maybe. You're handing them off when you get to different travels. So William is a lot of fun. I'm going to pass this notebook around, too. Pardon? I know people have gotten them back. What we did was we put a little note in. William's going to be homesick by June or whatever the year was. Please return him COD. You know, we'll pay for the postage. So people have gotten them back. I'll show you very quickly. Oh, yeah. A lot of the ideas I'm talking about, when I first started doing a geography workshop, I guess it was about 7 or 8 years ago, and I was preparing handouts, and I wanted to tell everything about all these ideas I'd found. My handout got really long, and it ended up into Hands-On Geography. That's how that book started. It was a really, really big handout. My husband says I'm obsessive-compulsive workaholic, so what do you expect? But this is a compilation of these kinds of ideas for the lower elementary grades. And then a few years ago, my kids were getting older, and I wanted to go more in depth. And my friend and I wrote the Ultimate Geography and Timeline Guide, which is a K-12 geography curriculum, everything you need except an atlas to teach geography. It has all these kinds of ideas, plus actual lesson plans for middle school, for high school, geography through literature, through history, a ton of other stuff. So there's that. Books. We like to do handmade books in our school, probably because I was not a geography major, I was an English major. And so anything I can do with books, I prefer. But there's so much you can do with geography, hands-on with books. I had a friend that made, have you ever seen the pop-up books or the pop-up cards? Now, I'm not real coordinated, and I haven't tried this, but she made a pop-up volcano card. So that's geography and science, and she and the kids made this pop-up volcano card. Well, that's really, the kids got into that. They had to label all the parts of it. They had to do a little bit of research, but they ended up with this really cool card. So that's one thing that you can do. One thing that we've tried, and this is really for middle school and high school. It's not as easy as it sounds. It's a See Inside book. Now, right now, it's not See Inside. I have to put the little page protectors in here to keep it from getting all scratched up as I travel around. But it's on overhead projector paper, and you start with an outline of a country. And this one happens to be South America. I have another one on Africa. And you have to think backwards. You have to think, well, what's the first thing that I'd want to see? Well, there's the outline of the country. What's the next thing that I could add on here? Or this one happens to be landforms. Okay, it's got rainforests and things like that is the last thing. So it's a See Inside book, but it's more complicated than you think. It's really best suited for the older kids. I have one on Africa too. These kinds of ideas are in the big book and in some of them are in the little book also. Oh, collections. Your kids collect stuff? Collections are great for geography. They're great for science. They're great for a lot of different things. Stamp collections. Wonderful. Postcards. It doesn't have to be from around the world. It can be from around the country. And, you know, my husband mentioned one time at work that his children collected stamps and postcards. And the next thing you knew, within a month, we had a big old baggie full of them because people at work had saved stuff, you know, that someone sent them back in the 1960s. And, you know, they thought it was really cool, but what were they going to do with it? And now, well, here's someone that can use it. And they wanted it to be used. So we ended up with stamps and letters and postcards from all over the place. And what we did with them the first year was we cut the stamps out. I'm not good at that, soaking them and pulling them off with the tweezers. That's just too detailed for me, you know. Give me the pair of scissors. Let me cut these babies out. And we took a map like this, except it was on the other side of this is a world map. And we took the stamps and we taped them all around the border. And the kids would take the vis-a-vis overhead projector pins and draw lines to where the stamp originated from, or to where the postcard originated from. So they ended up with a really cool looking map, and they got to learn about a lot of, just reading the backs of a lot of postcards is very historical. If you really got into the stamps, you can look up why that stamp was chosen, and you'll find out a lot of history and geography about a country based on what kind of stamp they chose. Same thing with money. Oh, go to the post office. Yeah, go to the post office. They have a lot of free stamp collecting things. I thought I brought one in, but I didn't. They have a lot of free booklets on stamp collecting, even for children. And also, you can call. I'm going to give you a phone number. Sorry, it's not on the handout. I didn't think to put it on the handout. If you have a pencil handy, you can call area code 516-759-7000. And for the price of just the shipping, they'll send you, this is American Stamp Dealers Association, they'll send you a free stamp album. This is for younger children. This isn't the kind that you have to soak them and then get them off of the tweezers. But this is an album where they can learn how to organize that collection by themes. For instance, this page is for birds, and this page is for trees, and they have one for transportation, all different things. And then they have some that are generic, like this, so they can make their own theme on a page like that. And not only are they learning about the country as they figure out where it came from, but classification is an important skill, whether it's geography or science or life in general. So they're also classifying, and that's a freebie. We like to collect money. My kids always like to collect money. Now they like American money better, but they've always liked money collecting. And when you collect money from around the world, not only do you find really interesting looking stuff, you know, different shapes and different things, but have them look up what that country is and something about what's on the country. And if you guys are collecting the 50 state quarters, if you have them research why they chose the emblem that they chose on that 50 state quarter, they'll learn something important about that particular state. That's a fun thing to do. Okay, a couple other book ideas. I'm going to pass this around. This is an ABC book of geography. This is good for any age. The assignment was to come up with a geographic term for every letter of the alphabet, to define it and to illustrate it. So here's D is for desert. There's a picture and there's an illustration. E is for the equator. Same thing, a picture and an illustration all the way through the alphabet, if you wouldn't mind passing that back. Let me show you a really quick hands-on thing that you can do. This is good really for any age, depending on the size piece that you decide on. But if you want a child to learn either their states or their countries around the world, get one of those outline maps, maybe something about like this size. You can enlarge it, you know, take it to your copy shop, enlarge it a little bit. And if it's a map, say, of Africa, have the student label or color in, depending on their age, all the different countries in Africa. When it's all labeled and colored in, just put some contact paper on both sides of it and then have them cut it out. Now, for older students, high school, they would cut it out country by country. But for little guys, you might cut it out into three or four or five regions. And what they're going to end up with is a laminated jigsaw puzzle that they can store in a little Ziploc bag and go back and remind themselves. They'll do their own puzzles that they made, you know, plus they're going to remember it better because they did it themselves. It's also great for the older kids to make one for a younger sibling, to help a younger sibling. And this student did it on the regions of the United States. She was learning her states and capitals, but that was a bit overwhelming for her, so her mom started out region by region. She learned her regions first, broke it down that way, and then went on to the states and capitals. Passport luncheon. Don't want to forget this. A couple of years ago, I guess 5 or 6 years ago, we were doing ancient Egypt, and I invited two other families to study ancient Egypt with us. And at the end of the unit, we decided that we would get together and kind of share what we learned, and we would have food. Something about food in school is just great. We would have food from, I'm sorry, not ancient Egypt, we did ancient Greece, food from Greece that we could share. Well, it kind of snowballed. We ended up making costumes and doing all kinds of things, and we had a day spent on what we learned about ancient Greece. And we got together, we shared the food, the kids wore their I forget what they're called, they're not togas, but you know, those wrap things. I didn't make them, I don't sew. But they really remembered that. It was a way to end the unit. And 2 years ago in my church, a woman started an Around the World night, which is similar to this, it's like a passport luncheon, except instead of doing a luncheon, we just did like a sample of kinds of foods. This Around the World night was open to any homeschooler in the church that wanted to participate. And what you do is you came and you set up a table about like this size, and you would have a map displaying your area of the world that you picked to study, and you would have some projects that you did, things that you learned about that country available there. And I wanted to show you on the overhead some of the ones that we did that were there. The top picture is Lindsay, and Lindsay had done a unit on Native American Indians, so she had a display on that. On her wall map, you may recognize that it's the same map as this, but she took stickers that she bought at the store on Native Americans, and she took the stickers and put them up in the appropriate places on the map. So it's a way that she really made that map very interesting. And she had, on the left, you'll see envelopes down the side. She has questions and answers. It's like a little game that she made up. What do you know about Native Americans? Stuck inside each of those envelopes. She had some books that she read, a Native American doll that she got, and some of her projects. And down at the bottom, this is Mike Zimmerman, the gentleman in the back, and his wife Darlene, the queen of frugal homeschoolers. They always make the best projects, and they're usually free. They took a bunch of cardboard boxes, and they did the Great Wall. They were doing China, and they did the Great Wall of China. And it's much longer than what you see here. Couldn't fit it all on the camera. But they did all their projects, the reports, the games, the photographs. What they did was they taped them all around the Great Wall of China. So they ended up with a 3D report, basically. And they didn't save all this. They took pictures of all of it, and they kept the pictures. There's a couple more I want to show you. I'm left-handed. I'm always in trouble with this. It even has arrows on there. It tells me which way to put it, and I get it backwards. This is Eric. Eric did ancient Rome. And one of the things I liked about Eric's costume, which was neat, you'll notice the Legos in the bottom corner over here. Legos are wonderful for geography because houses, habitats, and you know those kinds of things are important. What kind of housing a culture uses tells you a lot about their weather, their climate, their topography. And so you can use Legos, you can use any of those little things for them to build replicas or mock-ups. So he's got that. He's got some of these hands-on punch-out paper doll things. a not very nice map, and I think his mom typed it. It looks like his mom probably typed that report. The family on the bottom, the mom had been, as a college student, she had been to Togo, West Africa, on a missionary, short-term missionary trip, actually a couple months, I don't know, that's really short-term, and she had saved a lot of things that she had purchased over there, and she knew one day that if she was blessed to have children, she wanted to share this with them. And so the four children in this family studied Togo, West Africa, learned about the missions work going on there, and they made a display. She even brought back costuming for kids in case she ever had children, which she was hoping that she would before she was married. I thought that was pretty neat. The family at the top did Germany, really got into that. They did a lot of really neat maps. Some people do timelines to go along with it. And everyone brought some kind of food that would be representative of that area to share with the other families. And I tell you, we've done it the last 2 years now, and it's really been a motivation for people to do these hands-on kinds of things because you're going to go show. And a lot of the families, when you came to your booth, you were supposed to have a little passport with you. And we handed out a little passport guide. I just copied the one out of the hands-on geography, this little passport in here that you can make up. So we made them up at the copy shop. You know, we got them bound and stuff. And the idea is when you would go to a booth, they would put a stamp or a sticker or something in your passport that represented that country. And they came up, some of them made them out of potato stamps, some of them bought stickers, various things. What we did, the year that we did this, my youngest did Haiti. My older son's been on a missions trip there, and Tyler's going this year. And he's really excited about it. So we took a map of Haiti on one of our encyclopedia atlases and shrunk it down. I don't know, Tyler did this, but shrunk it down and printed it out on like label paper so it was sticky. So we just made our own little map stickers. But there's all kinds of different little things in there that you could do. Oh, I mentioned earlier science and geography. When you're doing hands-on things with science, not to forget the maps, but also remember if you're doing a geographic science unit, remember to count it for geography. For example, if you're studying weather, count it for science and count it for geography. One of the things that I love, and I walked out without it, big cloud chart that has photographs of each of the types of common and uncommon clouds. And on this big chart, the big laminated color chart, it tells you it gives you a definition of the cloud, tells you a little bit about it, and it has it in groupings from the most common to the least common. And it comes with a summary of forecast rules. I really think that in our society today, we have given over the thinking to the experts. You know, if you're not an expert, then you don't know anything about it. There's one. She's got one. She's great. Look at this. Would you mind holding that up? Just hold that baby up. Bring it up here. In our country, people don't know how to forecast the weather anymore. Thank you very much. This is what we're talking about. It's hard to describe it effectively. But my uncle can tell you what the weather is going to be tomorrow and the next day, and he's 99% right. My uncle's a farmer, and he's 80-something years old, and he's had to know, and it's important to him, what the weather is. And I think that we're so attuned to turning on the weather channel or checking the newspaper to see, is it going to rain today? Well, I don't know. Look outside. Look at the clouds and what you know about these types of clouds, and if the wind's coming from this direction, what does that mean? And that's what this forecast rule does. If you can identify the cloud, and you can also identify what direction the wind is coming from, get a compass, teach your kids how to use one, then you can know pretty effectively what your weather's going to be for the next 12 to 24 hours. And I just think it's important that our children know that it's not that experts aren't important. I don't want my family physician doing brain surgery on me, but I think that we've given away too much of that. And I think it's important that they learn that they can think for themselves and that they can be independent and not have to be depending on everybody else to do that sort of thinking for them. Thank you for that cloud chart. Don't forget to get it back. If you're doing weather, there's this lady in Pennsylvania named Esther Yant who wrote a book a few years ago called Over Our Heads in Wonder. And what she did was she tied scripture to weather. And this is just, and she publishes it herself, and this is a very, very neat little book. She has science experiments with Bible verses that have to do with weather. She has activities in the Bible verses. She even has things like, if it's a rainy day, you go to the rainy day chapter and you can do a rainy day activity, or a stormy day, or a sunny day, or a snowy day, or a, you know, cloudy day. Those kinds of things. You can look it up by activity. So when you're doing that, don't think, oh, I haven't done any geography this year. Well, gosh, you just did weather. Maybe you did some astronomy along with that. Maybe you did some earth science. Well, you did teach geography. Don't feel like you only taught geography if you taught a class that says geography on it. Someone asked me earlier, when did you begin teaching geography? And I said, once you understand what the definition of geography is, you'll realize that you've been teaching geography all along. But when do you start giving an emphasis to geography? I would really recommend by first or second grade that you spend at least once or twice a month for maybe an hour, hour and a half, and pick one or two geography projects up here that you liked or something else that you've thought of, and concentrate on those. The other thing that I would recommend for the beginning in the early grades is to have a big outline map up, have a atlas that's age appropriate, and begin using it just in your everyday life. You just got a letter from Grandma who's on her way to Arizona to visit Great Uncle Ned. Well, follow that on a map. Where does she have to go to get there? Those kinds of things. If you begin doing them naturally, your child is gaining all kinds of geographic awareness before you even really start teaching geography. Then somewhere around the fifth or sixth grade, I recommend a pure geography course. There's one in the Ultimate Geography and Timeline Guide. You can make up your own, but something where they're learning their way around the world. They can identify places. You might also want to buy a map skills book at some point so they learn how to read maps and learn how to read graphs and charts, things like that are important. Don't let your high school student leave home without a good, solid geography course somewhere along the way. Don't let your high school student leave home without learning how to read a road map effectively. Here I am, the geography queen in my house, and my son graduated, had his driver's license, and we realized belatedly that he knew the material in his head, but he hadn't had the experience and map reading as far as a road map to really be safe finding his way from one place to another. So it's really something that you need to stop and teach. If you don't know how to use a compass, if you don't know how to use a road map, if you don't know how to use a gazetteer in the back of an atlas, it's okay. Learn how to do that yourself and learn it with your children or learn it and teach your children. But it's too important not to know. And I want to close with, you're going to be amazed here. I want to close with a couple of questions from, are you ready? The eighth grade final exam from 1895. Did you see this in Salina, Kansas? Here's a couple of questions for geography. They have 1 hour to answer these questions. What is climate? What does climate depend on? How do you account for the extremes of climate in Kansas? Of what use are rivers? Describe the mountains of North America. Name and describe the following: Monrovia, Odessa, Denver, Manitoba, Hecla, Yukon, St. Helena, Juan Fernandez, Aspinwall, and Orinoco. Name and locate the principal trade centers of the U.S. Name all the republics of Europe and give capital of each. Why is the Atlantic coast colder than the Pacific in the same latitude? Describe the process by which the water of the ocean returns to the sources of rivers. Describe the movements of the earth, and you have 1 hour. Our geographic education in the country today stinks. I could spend the hour giving you examples of just horrible stories, true stories that I've either had happen to me or happened to other people about people's lack of geographic knowledge. Please instruct your children in geography. Realize the importance of it. They will be more productive citizens. They'll be able to cast better votes. They'll understand the world around them better if they have a solid geographic foundation. My company is Bright Ideas Press. I'm booth number 62, and most of what I have up here today, I do sell in the booth, and our toll-free number is on your handout. You can come by and get a catalog, or you can call us later for a catalog. Thank you all very much for coming today.